And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, the secret oaths, and the secret proceedings.
The show that asks questions about why we don't ask questions.
What the hell is going on?
This is Conspiracy Queries with Alan Parr. Welcome to Conspiracy Queries. With Alan Park. These are the conspiracy queries. I am the Alan Park. Thought I'd wait a little bit and see if I confused you. Maybe you thought you got a bum download. That's happened before. Sometimes you think you have a bum download, but really what's going on is you're a victim of hacking. So thanks for listening to us. I know last week we had the DDoS attack, and today's guest, Barry Zwicker, will be here to discuss the attack from his perspective and share with you how it helps color his world. A very fascinating guy, a researcher, television producer, author, Barry Zwicker. So stick around for him. We will be discussing that DDoS attack. Let's hope we don't get any more of those.
Fascism.
According to John McAfee, of course, the famous computer software hacker genius, it became evident that they cheated Bernie Sanders out of being the nominee. Fewer people wanted Hillary to be the nominee, so they made that happen in their democracy. McAfee says the DNC's thing was leaked by Iran hacking it. We've heard also Russia has hacked it. Could have been some kid in a basement somewhere. But McAfee also claims that North Korea hacked the DYN. That's the cybersecurity legend John McAfee looks to the dark web for answers on the DNC and DYN hacks. This is from CSOnline.com. John McAfee, in an email exchange, said sources within the dark web saying it was Iran. And he absolutely agrees. While Russian hackers get more media attention nowadays, Iranian hackers have had their share. But you know what? I don't know who hacked it. I'm just really upset about the fact that in the case of the DNC, yeah, okay, Russia hacked it, Iran hacked it. Who cares who hacked it? What about what's in it? Why aren't you embarrassed for the disgusting manipulation of your supposed democracy away from a guy who should have had it and was way high in the polls and I'm sure would have beaten a Trump? He's like 10 or 12 or 15 points ahead of Trump while Hillary clings to a 1 or 2 point either lead or deficit.
Fascism.
With her just about to collapse and fall on a car fingernails. So, you know, who cares who did it? Although it is important who did it. So I shouldn't be too glib with that. All right, let's move on to one more thing I want to say. Just before we get to wanttoknow.info, today we are going to be... This is a great website, wanttoknow.info. Chapter 3, Psychopathy, Power, and Politics. I didn't know those could be separated. Oh, that's good. We're looking forward to that. Okay, so I just want to say before... I should have done this first, but I'm suffering from a bit of a cold today. It's nothing compared to the usual load of shit that comes down the pike, But I'll do it now. This is on MSN.com from a couple of weeks ago. UFO expert found dead days after texting mom, quote, "Your boy's in trouble. If anything happens to me, investigate," close quote. From the Mirror in England, just days before his mysterious death, Max Spears, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Spears, a father to two boys, was found dead on a sofa in Poland, where he had gone to give a talk about conspiracy theories and UFOs. He was ruled to have died from natural causes, despite no post-mortem examination being carried out on his body. So I'm very sorry for Max. He tried to get to the truth. I don't know him, but he's another truth teller that is no longer with us. So my heart goes out to him and his family. Just before we get to our interview, here we are with wanttoknow.info. Here we go, Chapter 3, Psychopathy, Power, and Politics, and from Robert Reber, who is a psychologist, he says, and opens the chapter with, "There is no thing in the psychopathic universe as the merely weak. Whoever is weak is also a sucker, that is, someone who demands to be exploited." Psychopathy. What exactly does the word mean? Entertainment media bombards us with a particular version of the psychopath, one that is irrational, dangerous, and violent. Someone who doesn't fit in, who just doesn't seem right. Is this an accurate description? Dr. Robert D. Hare, an eminent psychologist on the subject, portrays the disorder in a drastically different light. In his book Without Conscience, he describes psychopaths as being conscienceless yet rational, not suffering from any insanity or debilitation. Instead, they are logical, manipulative, predisposed to crime, selfish, and without guilt, shame, remorse, or empathy. In other words, these men and women are not mentally ill in the sense that we traditionally imagine. Psychopathy is surely an illness, but it is not a neurosis that will manifest symptoms others can easily perceive. Often, the psychopath will be aware of his condition and completely conceal his aberrant traits. In Without Conscience, Dr. Hare presents numerous case studies and statistics to illuminate the world of the psychopath. The evidence points towards a world full of people programmed for evil. Dr. Hare stresses multiple times that the psychopath is someone who has a strong desire for power and the need to manipulate others, not for personal gain, but simply for the sake of manipulation. While some psychopaths are erratic, others have the ability to completely conceal their condition behind a carefully constructed social persona, such as a presidential candidate, for example. Dr. Hare's list of psychopathic personality traits include displaying glibness and superficial charm. Ooh, vote for me. Being in constant need of stimulation and prone to excessive boredom. Acting in a conning or manipulative way. Showing shallow emotional responses. Acting out promiscuous sexual behavior. Behaving irresponsibly. Avoiding long-term relationships. Feeling a grandiose sense of self-worth. Lying repeatedly without remorse. Lacking any remorse or guilt. Lacking empathy for others. Having poor behavioral controls. Displaying behavioral problems early on in life. Behaving impulsively. Failing to accept responsibility for actions. Displaying signs of criminal diversity. Dr. Hare's predecessor, Harvey Kleckley, perhaps the first psychologist to study the psychopathic phenomenon decades earlier, compiled a similar list, which I won't go into. But there are similar lists there. Now, you do have to be careful because there are some things on here that are, normal situations like this. Harvey Kleckley includes unreliability as a psychopathic personality trait. Of course, if you're going to be late to catch a bus, that doesn't really mean you're a psychopath. But it goes into how these particular traits weasel their way into the mindset of those wielding corporate power. Most of the case studies Dr. Hare presents in his book are from the prison population and anecdotal accounts from those who have been abused. This is a natural structural problem in the study of psychopathy. The study is limited for the most part to the unsuccessful psychopath, those who could not conceal their traits, or those whose social circumstances led to blue-collar crime. Yet Dr. Hare also spends some significant time devoted to the subdeviant criminal, the psychopath who has control over his deviance and the ability to hide it from the populace. Instead of the petty criminal, these men and women occupy positions in business, government, industry, and law. Their condition goes entirely unnoticed by the populace. Except for you, because you wrote this website and I'm reading it and people are listening to it. Their employers, peers, and even their family and those who love them are fooled. How can such deception be possible? Consider that psychopathy is not an acquired illness. Instead, it has strong genetic components and manifests itself early in childhood. From an early age, the psychopath recognizes that to fit into society in any manner, they need to develop the ability to lie extensively. Over time, they become exceptionally good at it. And it goes on to the next category. Their entire public persona becomes one complex act, a web of lies to hide their deviant personality. So guess what? There are also chapters, subchapters in here on sadism, secondary psychopathy, and the pathocracy, which is going to be about government. Let's read that. The psychopathy is not a rare phenomenon. Dr. Hare estimates that psychopaths consist of 1% of the population, Other psychologists have estimates as high as 4%. It's probably around 10 by now. That represents between 3 and 12 million Americans, millions of which are the sub-deviant criminals of Dr. Hare's lexicon, residing in positions of power with a psychological need to control and manipulate others. They are drawn to certain occupations that allow them to wield power over others, such as police, military, intelligence, and finance. Over time, they begin to saturate important institutions, being more ruthless and willing to cause more destruction in their rise up the ladder of power than their competition, in the exact same manner that you and I naturally exclude deviants from our social groups. Psychopaths naturally exclude those of us who allow conscience and morality to influence our decisions and perceptions. The result is a web of mutual conditioning of evil, where goals and actions become increasingly removed from the institution's original intention. This process has been occurring for centuries in banks, clandestine agencies, military, police, and governments in nearly every instance, hiding behind rhetoric and ideology that masks their true nature. So they're always involved. These are the people that we're talking about. That's who we are featuring on the show, not our guest today. Our guest today is fantastic, and he knows about these people, and he has lots of interesting things to say, and I sure hope you enjoy your time with him as much as I do. It's Barry Zwicker, folks, so let's go to our interview.
And it occurred to me there's sort of four headings for this DDoS topic that we're on, and I'm pretty sure it'll expand. And one
the topic will expand?
The DDoS is part of the internet infrastructure, involves necessarily this vast spy system run by the NSA and the Brits, and includes the Five Eyes surveillance.
Yeah, New Zealand and Australia, Britain, Canada,
New Zealand.
New Zealand, right.
Sorry, yeah. Guys. So that's what I mean by expansion, that this can lead and probably should lead us to looking at a larger picture. But for now, there's my personal internet experiences this past Friday.
Oh, hey, take it easy. We don't want to hear about your personal internet experiences.
Well, I won't use any colorful language. Okay. I'll just bowdlerize everything. But last Friday when the DDoS hit, and then the second is the mainstream coverage of those DDoS attacks. There's more coverage even in today's paper on the 25th. About these attacks. Third, and this is where the expansion can come in. This is a wide area, speculating who's behind these attacks and what are the motives of these attacks. And fourth and finally, minor thing, but it's back to sort of practical on-the-ground stuff, a small research survey that I hope to undertake tomorrow evening. And you know a bit about that, and we can come to it.
Okay, let's do that. Anyway, my
personal experiences was last Friday. I simply wanted to go to the Hamilton Spectator, WWW, the Spec, because I wanted to make a comment on an opinion piece published. It was published one day before the second anniversary of the Parliament Hill shootings in Ottawa October the 22nd, 2014. Now, this is relevant to my personal experience, and then it expands to larger fields. So this opinion piece by Graham asked some uncomfortable questions that threw into doubt the official story.
And anytime the official story is thrown into doubt on a publication, I want to just stop and say, and what's that publication? Where can we see this quickly?
You can try and probably today get through to WWW, the Spec, thespec.com, about the Ottawa shooting. Graham's very last line is words this effect: we need a full, honest inquiry about this shooting on Parliament Hill.
Sure. But how does that tie into the DDoS?
Yeah, well, it would take me too long to explain in detail how I was at first stymied in leaving a causative comment about his article. I knew about the article because he'd sent it to me in advance and asking me to not distribute it.
And what's his name again?
it's Graeme. His first name is spelled G-R-A-E-M-E, Graeme. Okay. And McQueen, capital M, little A-C, and then Queen with a cap Q.
Sure.
Graeme McQueen, wonderful, retired professor, but very youthful from McMaster University. He founded the Center for Conflict Studies at McMaster and very much a 9/11 truther. And he wrote a whole book about the fraudulent anthrax attacks.
Oh, sure, back in right after 9/11.
Yeah. So he's a substantial person, and he's very, very careful in how he writes. Well, anyway, in the comment that I prepared, that this is a careful, reasoned, and important opinion piece, and I congratulate The Spectator for publishing it, because many mainstream media outlets would not.
No,
well,
sure.
So I went to leave my comment. So I went to create my account, but then the site wouldn't accept it because I got a notice from something called CloudForce that there's no such website. CloudForce could not find. I couldn't believe it. So I went around about three times, and it kept stopping me every time. Then I was able to complete creating the account, and subsequently I was able to put in my comment.
Okay.
So I just thought, well, they're having trouble at the Spec website, and I should get in touch with the IT person there and say that there's some glitch. And I would, in all humility, when I reached the IT person, I'd say, it could be my own fumbling and non-tech capacity, but I've been a responsible internet citizen, a responsible netizen, and I thought I'll go on with my day's work.
Well, now, I might have to cut some of that out of the show.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I shouldn't have put that in. The reason I mention that is because this is real. This is non-speculative. This is actual fact on the ground. So then after I did that, there's some alert comes in that there's been this DDoS attack. This is probably what's happened to me, and it's happening to lots of people. And so then I start to look into it. The media coverage was pretty good, but on the other hand, what the media coverage said is that this is puzzling, okay? Collateral damage is being cited as the most likely cause for Canada's involvement in the series of internet outages that swept across North America and parts of Europe Friday. And then it goes on to say cyber attacks on DYN, D-Y-N.
D-Y-N, yeah.
Yeah, a key internet firm repeatedly disrupted the availability of popular websites across the United States Friday. Some key quotes. Carmen Levy, a CTV technology analyst, described a DDoS attack similar to a pitchfork-wielding mob showing up at your door and only being disruptive enough to make sure you can't leave or get anything done. So, in other words, it's disruption. Analysts say that the borderless nature of the internet means you could be anywhere in the world and still experience issues trying to load up certain pages,
sure,
which is what happened to me.
Yeah.
Okay. While DDoS attacks on things like specific websites are common, an attack of this scale is relatively new. Now get this, quote, we've seen some speculation that this is a state-sponsored attack or a state-involved attack. And the only reason that is on the radar is because typically only a state would have the resources required to execute an attack like this in one fell swoop.
No, I agree.
Yeah, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security is monitoring the situation. White House spokesman Josh Earnest told reporters he had no information about who may be behind the disruption. The last paragraph in this one story, respected security expert Bruce Schneier, S-C-H-N-E-I-E-R, said last month, someone is extensively testing the core defensive capabilities of the companies that provide critical internet services.
Sure.
Now, obviously, this also impacts individuals. So I have to ask, and this is getting a bit paranoid, in all the reportage, the only other newspaper that was attacked apparently was the New York Times. There may have been more. It's just that I just haven't been able to find a reference to other newspapers.
Haven't done all the research. Yeah.
So now why would the Hamilton Spectator be attacked on the very day that there's an opinion piece which questions, in the essence calls a false flag, the attack on Canada's Parliament Hill?
I don't know. That's
almost
amazing.
2 years ago to the day. I mean, is there a connection?
I do have it up on the computer now, so it did manage to survive the attack, and the Hamilton Spectator website, it's up, and I do have that article.
Oh, no, it'll be there again. This really expands it. Let's go back to the Internet as a whole.
No, you're not kidding.
Yeah, what a hole. A dark hole, black hole. But I'm not a troglodyte. I mean, I got involved with the Internet early on and got involved with computers in 88, probably in the 90s I got on the Internet. But I've never become, you know, a techie or anything close to it. But anyway, it became more and more evident than Edward Snowden's revelations nailed it down, that the Internet is a huge playground for these nasty spy agencies. They use the Internet to harvest, to surveil and harvest millions, probably tens of millions, even as probably becoming hundreds of millions of people, with more and more ability to be specific, to home right in on Alan Park's computer and Barry Zwicker's computer.
Hey, whoa, don't invite him in. Come on.
There's no question they have that sophistication. So that's not paranoia. That is, remember what Edward Snowden said to Laura Poitras.
For the movie, right? What was that movie called again?
Just called Snowden.
Oh, okay, right.
So Edward said to Laura early on, when he contacted her because he trusted her, and she had done work in this field, she produced a whole film about Internet spying by the NSA and the likes. And he said, Laura, you've got to encrypt. I cannot do one more thing unless you encrypt. And he said, you realize you're dealing with people who can make a trillion guesses per second when they're searching for a password.
Huh.
Yeah. So, I mean, that is the kind of sophistication we're dealing with. These agencies use the Internet to harvest information, which they're better and better and better
at doing,
at slicing and dicing right down to individual persons. It's not only how they collect the information, and they keep saying our agencies, CSIS and CSE in Canada, they keep saying, well, we just collect metadata. You know, it's just who phones who. We don't ever listen in on conversations or anything. No. They've got the sophistication to get conversations, have them instantly translated from any language and so on, to have them grouped and analyzed psychographically in every other way. They've got all that. I mean, look, the NSA employs more mathematicians than all the U.S. universities combined. We can't imagine how sophisticated they are. And anybody who thinks that he or she cannot be targeted right at his or her computer is just a deaf, dumb, and blind babe in the woods. So we got to get that through our heads, not to be fearful about it. As Snowden and others say, we have to speak our voices and not be cowed. But the thing is, we should not be naive about how vast this surveillance thing is. So what do you do when you have, even a product? What do the military do when they've got a bomb? It's got to be tested.
And the more testing they do is more to the product life, which they have in the first place for monetary gain. Even though they might find it doesn't work properly. But then once they start to use it, they may take it over into the theater of operations in a war somewhere, of which we have many going on right now. And they will use it there and either leave it behind for ISIS so they can use it against us, or they'll somehow bring it back and provide it to police departments. Or
yeah.
Sold to the police, or whatever you want to say, and now you're militarizing the entire our entire existence from top to tail.
Well, yeah. I mean, the militarization of the police has really gone. It's getting to ridiculous lengths where they have armored vehicles and they wear body armor and they've got all sorts of sophisticated devices for crowd control and so on.
I mean, it seems like they're giving these guys more body armor than there was a problem giving armor to guys that were in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, these guys were having to forge and create their own body armor out of junk and bits they were finding on the ground because they weren't being provided with enough body armor while they were over there in an illegal war operation. But somehow the cops in our own country, in our own cities, they can have the same kind of equipment.
Yeah, and something that ties in with that is that a huge proportion of the members of police forces in the USA are ex-military. I mean, you're getting literally military-trained people who have left the armed forces and joined police forces. So
it's same kind of thinking, same kind of regimented.
Yeah, and they know all about weapons and crowd control and so on. They know how to break into houses and so on and so on. But I was talking about testing, not mainly. In connection with the military, even though that I agree with you on all that. But I'm talking about testing in the sense of product testing.
Okay.
But I'll just say that much, and then I'm going to back up again to the Internet as a whole. So the Internet is a brilliant surveillance tool for, let's say, the NSA, all those who harvest digital information, which is also very much human information.
Sure.
It's SIGINT and HUMINT.
As in signal intelligence and human intelligence.
Correct. It's a vast harvesting operation, but then they take the information and they can use it to disrupt. But they have to test all this. Now, the other side of the Internet is that it's valuable to those of us who use it to run an Internet radio show. And so this way, people like us can exchange information in a democratic free speech way. And there are many, many uses of the Internet like that. Now, the more of us there are who are using our friends and information we gather and free democratic exchange of information on the Internet to see how bad the militarized surveillance police state is becoming, and where we become alarmed and we have to defend our freedoms, our liberties, our human and civil rights, then we become a threat to them. But they've got us all under surveillance. So at some point, they may think that the threat that the percentage of the population that is seeing how bad is the corruption and the threat of these fascistic, militarized police states, then we become a real threat to them. So then they have to think about shutting the Internet down. So it's a great boon to them, and it's a great threat to them.
So you figured the DDoS interruptions were basically a testing of the powers that be to make sure?
I think it could be a beta test.
Because it's a giant toy. If you have the operational levers, the controls, and they're testing them out in a way they don't usually test them out.
Yeah, and that's why I think we need to do our own testing.
Some people say don't put anything out there about because they're seeing everything. I was like, I'm so past having left a clean trail for that now. I just, I'm out here. Don't worry about it. I'm out here and I'm saying what I'm saying and I'm recording you and I'm putting it out there into the world so people can think about these things and ask themselves the questions, why do these things continue to take place? Who are these people? Who are these people? Who are these people that continue to make things so filled with trouble and hate and fear and war all the time? We don't need it. We don't want that. You ask anybody, they don't want to do that. That's not what they're interested in getting up to. But somehow you become a cog in a machine and they lie to you and tell you you can't have medicine that's free and available. And they sell you some other stuff that's not and tested and irradiated and packed with ingredients. And you're getting sick and tired of this thing. Barry, I hope you don't get offended, but I can leave this out of the show if you like. You're like 80 something. We're going to have a birthday soon, right?
I'll be 82 on November the 5th.
Okay. 82 on remember the 5th of November. That's you're going to be 82. So you're only 81 right now.
Yeah.
Okay. You're sharp as a tack. You have seen a lot of things and you're very articulate and on top of things, and not to disparage everyone in their 80s, but I've known you for about 12 years or something, and in your lifespan, where are we now compared to when you started paying attention to all of these goings-on?
I welcome that. I mean, thank you for your kind words, and insofar as they're true, you can use it.
Okay.
And I won't tell you the parts that are untrue. So, because the fact is that a certain number of years go by, and you're in better position to see patterns in your life to date. And you've asked me about those patterns, and it's a big subject, but somehow I did get a good start in this sense, that I was raised in a household that you might say was partially alienated. It's a good thing to be alienated. Various authors have said that it's a blessing if you feel you're an outsider, because then you see things differently from the tribe, from the general run of the crowd. And so I've always felt it was a plus to be the son of a United Church minister who was very progressive and who got spied on by the Mounties. And I learned that when I was about 12 years old, had my first encounter with Mounties, not only spying on my dad, but harassing him, trying to put him out of a job twice. When you look back on it, that was a blessing. It was a good start, because I didn't take it for granted that the police were benign.
You're supposed to.
Well, yeah, but most police are okay. When I'm pulled over, and I don't give him or her any lip, you know,
right,
or anything, they're doing their job. But it's different with the likes of the Mounties and CSIS, because they are political police, which I learned when I was 12 years old. And there were other things that I learned in my younger life that have stuck with me, because when I was a teenager, it was the McCarthy era.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it. If a person consistently reads and advocates the views expressed in a communist publication, he may be a communist. If a person supports organizations which reflect communist teachings, or organizations labeled communist by the Department of Justice, she may be a communist. If a person defends the activities of communist nations while consistently attacking the domestic and foreign policy of the United States, she may be a communist. If a person does all these things over a period of time, he must be a communist. But there are other communists who don't show their real faces, who work more silently.
And so I remember lying in the top bunk. My brother was in the lower one, and he was 7 years younger than me, and I was in the upper bunk bed in Swan River, Manitoba, in the Swan River Valley. And this would be 1946, 47, 48, during the height of the McCarthy hearings. And I loved the radio, and I would leave it on literally all night. Sometimes my dad had to go and pull the main electric switch for the house to get me to stop listening to that radio.
Radio, yeah.
And the thing is, the reception in the Swan River Valley was terrific for the big U.S. stations. The signals, you know, from those stations, and they were 50,000 watt, bounced off the ionosphere, came in loudly and clearly. So I have a clear recollection. I know autobiographical memory is dicey, but I have a clear recollection of lying in the top bunk there, listening to my Northern Electric little radio.
The thing that the American people can do is to be vigilant day and night to make sure they don't have communists teaching the sons and daughters of America. Now, I realize that the minute anyone tries to get a communist out of a college, out of a university, there will be raised the phony cry that you're interfering with academic freedom. I would like to emphasize that there is no academic freedom where a communist is concerned. He is not a free agent. He has no freedom of thought, no freedom of expression. He must take his orders from Moscow, or he will no longer be a member of the Communist Party. I may say, Mr. Jenkins, I don't care how much of a screwball or a crackpot any professor or teacher may be, as long as he or she is a free agent. But once you have this United States, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, covered with a network of professors and teachers who are getting their orders from Moscow, from an organization that wants to destroy this nation, that wants to corrupt the minds of youth, then, Mr. Jenkins, we are rapidly losing the battle. The thing that I think we must remember is that this is a war which a brutalitarian force has won to a greater extent than any brutalitarian force has won a war in the history of the world before. For example, Christianity, which has been in existence for 2,000 years, has not converted, convinced nearly as many people as this communist brutalitarianism has enslaved in 106 years. And they're not going to stop. I know that many of my good friends seem to feel that this is sort of a game you can play. That you can talk about communism as though it's something 10,000 miles away. Mr. Jenkins, to answer your question, let me say it's right here with us now. If we, unless we, make sure that there is no infiltration of our government, then just as certain as you sit there, in the period of our lives, you will see a red world.
And hearing Senator McCarthy in his nasal voice saying, "Are you or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
The average American can do very little insofar as digging communist espionage agents out of our government is concerned. They must depend upon those of us whom they send down here to man the watchtowers of the nation."
And then I remember, the people who were there as witnesses under fire, they'd be people like professors and screenwriters and so on.
Sure.
And they would say, "Well, it's not that simple." And McCarthy, "Just answer the question, yes or no. Are you or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? And right then, I totally identified with the witness. McCarthy was such a bully. And so this was part of my education, my political education about the United States of America. And now we're seeing, as the New York Times magazine a couple of weeks ago ran a huge article about the new McCarthyism. So sometimes, when you get to be my age, you see patterns.
Exactly. And that's why I trust you're shrewd. You're obviously, on top of things and you're old. So I wanted to ask you, you've seen it all. You've seen much. You've seen so much. And that's why I wanted to pick your brain. Hey, so what else is going on for you right now?
Well, speaking of my birthday, which you introduced, 5th of November.
Remember.
Gunpowder Day or Guy Fawkes Day. Mm-hmm. And so it's a working day for me. It's a Saturday, and I'm going to be doing a presentation at Beit Zetoun, B-E-I-T-Z-A-T-O-U-N, Beit Zetoun on Markham Street in Toronto. It's a wonderful place. It's been going for 7 years in support of the Palestinians' cause and all sorts of terrific causes, everything about the ecosystem and so on.
You're speaking on all these different topics, or there are other speakers there?
Well, on Saturday, this goes back 7 years that they deal with human rights, civil rights, the environment, global warming, all sorts of justice campaigns of all kinds. And there'd be three or four events per week for 7 years. They've been about 1,000 events.
And so for this one, you're going to be speaking soon on what topic now?
So on Gunpowder Day, I'm going to be speaking about Guy Fawkes himself. And I'm going to have a special guest. And I'm going to talk about the Gunpowder Plot of 1605, which is one of the earliest false flag operations.
Tell me what a false flag is. You got 1 minute. Go.
False flag operation is where a country or an army or some entity fakes an attack upon itself and then blames an exterior party as having done the attack.
Why would you do that?
Well, that would be, for instance, it's easy to start a war that way. A country just says, oh my God, this other country attacked.
And for the brand new listener, by the way, brand new listener, thank you for tuning in. Why would you want to have a war?
Well, because there's profit in it, huge profit in war. As a matter of fact, I've been doing research for preparing for this Guy Fawkes. We're calling it Guy Fawkes Night at Beit Satun, and asking people to bring their Guy Fawkes masks that were introduced in the movie V for Vendetta. And we'll blow up some myths together. That's how the promo reads.
That's great.
And so I've been doing research on it and got very deeply into the wars that were happening in the 1500s and 1600s. And as a matter of fact, Guy Fawkes was, of course, caught at the last minute with 36 barrels of gunpowder. And the idea was that him and his co-conspirators were planning to blow up the Parliament buildings in London. And that would be, as several authors have noted, and there's about five books about this that I've seen, it would be the equivalent of 9/11 today. Nothing happened, you know, because Guy Fawkes was caught. And so the barrels of gunpowder could not be set off. But part of the false flag operation was that gunpowder was of such an inferior quality, it would not have exploded. And also there was a claim that there was a tunnel the conspirators had built in order to get to the underneath the Parliament buildings. No tunnel was ever found. There's various falsities, you see, various falsities involved in this false flag operation. But nevertheless, there were 12 or 13 conspirators, and they were all either shot when they were found or they were hanged after a one-day sham trial.
Now, Barry, I gave you 1 minute. We're almost at 3 minutes now.
Come on. Oh, God. This is terrible. I give you the 3 minute version. But anyway, this is relevant, though, to our overall conversation, I do believe, because there's so much deception that is perpetrated by the state, almost all states, including Canada, including the police forces in Canada that have carried off false operations, or if not, their stings where people are targeted. Usually they're mentally disabled, they're drug addicts, they're poverty stricken, and so on. And they're tricked into saying or doing something that could be called a terrorist act or a plan to do a terrorist act. And then they are arrested and they generate headlines.
Sure, like the folks in BC a couple of years ago on Canada Day with the bomb plot that was all turned out to be the RCMP facilitated it from A to Z.
Exactly. Yeah. That was Christopher Nuttall and Amanda Carotti.
And the amount of attacks and pre-attacks and those types of things that do take place in the States when they're going to blow something up, or Zihaf Bibo, the guy in Ottawa that did the shooting, apparently, who was also, you wrote about that in your website. Oh, let's also plug the website you constantly contribute towards.
Well, that's Truth and Shadows. truthandshadows.wordpress.com. Thank you for mentioning that, because it's a very good site, truthandshadows.wordpress.com, but I think that also truthandshadows.com. Valuable stuff there about the 9/11 false flag operation.
Sure.
And also Craig McKee, who founded it and runs it, sticks to his mandate very well. But of course, the mandate is not just 9/11 truth, but also state crimes against democracy, various false flag operations that happen. Those in society who are fighting to keep lines of information open and to keep free civil and democratic discourse alive, such as we're having now. And that's why the latest assaults on academic freedom have become part of the reportage on Truth and Shadows, the leading example being Professor Tony Hall of the University of Lethbridge, 26 years tenured professor, fired from his job without pay, with no proper hearing at all. And
why?
So we have to go to his defense.
Why? What did he do? What's his firing reason?
Is allegedly anti-Semitism. The organization that has been instrumental in having him fired is B'nai B'rith Canada. It's a fascinating story and an important one, and I hope you could have Tony on. I would highly recommend that.
Tony?
Hall, H-A-L-L, like the kids in the hall.
You know, when you say kids in the hall, I know you're referencing Jack Benny rather than the group that took their name from Jack Benny.
I have no idea who I'm referencing these days.
Okay, I'll just go back and erase that part where I said you were sharp.
Take out the sharp part.
Yeah.
I would just say this just to as okay. Sort of a intriguing hook that would get people interested in this. It's like a really good detective story. There was a post went up on Tony's Facebook page, absolutely anti-Semitic, allegedly put up by somebody named Glenn Davidson in Alberta. And Tony Hall knows this Glenn Davidson not too well, and he has deliberately not contacted him for, I think, pretty good reasons. Whether Glenn Davidson posted this, Tony did not post this thing on his own Facebook page, this horribly anti-Semitic thing.
This is the same mentality, though, decades ago when a cop would drop a joint in your pocket while they're talking to you, and then when you go to the station and they check you and all of a sudden you've got marijuana, they're going to arrest you with something else, or dropping a little bag of coke in the back of the car. It sounds like the same MO, but with digital technology.
That's right. It's a setup. And as a matter of fact, it's a kind of false flag operation. There's different definitions of them. They're kind of
related. You've already blown your minute on false flags, so just carry
on.
Yeah.
So Tony, he was not on his Facebook page. He was down visiting a friend in the United States when this was posted. Well, meanwhile, while he's away, the B'nai B'rith says this is horrible. They notify the university administration that Tony has posted this, which is completely wrong, you see. And yet on that basis, they fire him to like a star chamber. Then the story gets even more interesting because The post used an image taken from an artist, digital internet artist in Wisconsin named Ben Garrison. Garrison said that his image was hijacked by a young guy in Florida named Josh, I can't forget his last name. And this kid in Florida has been taking Ben Garrison's work and other people's work and twisting it around to make it look anti-Semitic and then posting it wherever he cares to do.
Well, that's an assault.
It is. So Ben Garrison is being smeared in an ongoing cascade. Tony Hall is being smeared. And it's B'nai B'rith taking this evidence, which isn't even true, and using it in order to have an academic fired. And it's not the first one that they've tried to have fired, and some of them have been fired, and some of them fought back and been reinstated, and some of them have lost.
So this all comes down the pike, though, of we need to conform to the agenda. And if there's a perception or any kind of problem of someone going outside the agenda, they just steamroll past them and damn their rights be damned. Is that what's happening?
Well, that's one way of putting it.
Two things. Number one, your thoughts on the upcoming U.S. election. Number two, anything else you want to talk about that's dire and we should be paying attention to that might have escaped our attention but might not have escaped yours?
Well, the U.S. election, it's just too juicy and horrible. Speaking of truth and shadows, I wrote last November a long piece about Donald Trump. The riff that I was building on was that there had been a certain number of stories that I'd found in the Globe and Mail and elsewhere that had a common headline, is Trump a fascist? Now, that was very late coming in the media for that question even to be asked. A greater percentage of those columnists in the mainstream media who raised the question, is Trump a fascist, futzed around with it and said, well, not really, you know, he'd have to be worse, he'd have to go further, he'd have to do this and do that to meet the criteria of being a fascist. Well, the piece that I wrote, the headline was something like, is Trump a fascist? No, it's worse than that. He's a Nazi. And it's even worse than that, because his followers are turning into Nazis, too.
Oh, sure, yeah. It's going to be ugly when the actual winner is declared. Yeah, the other side's going to go nuts.
He's worse. Like, he was called a buffoon at first. They called Hitler a buffoon. They did. And in my piece for Truth and Shadows, which you can look it up, I gave about 20 proven academic characteristics of Nazism.
Okay.
And Trump fit almost all of them. Now, to come to the present time, John Doyle, television columnist for the Globe and Mail, dealing with the fact that when the election is over, if Trump loses, most say they will, he will lose, but it's not for sure.
You can't tell.
Yet.
You don't know.
You never know what could happen.
What's the agenda?
But in any event, if he loses, apparently he has plans to set up a whole TV operation, a whole TV channel. And there's actually a vacuum there, because even Fox News, he's too much for Fox News. So yeah. There's going to be a vacuum. And all these millions of people have been sucked in by him, a vast kind of neo-Nazi cluster of the American population that's always been there, but has been awakened by Trump's bullying and narcissistic demagoguery, will have a channel to look at. It'll immediately have a lot of viewers. He says this is really alarming because that's not going to go away. He's going to try to undermine the Clinton regime. And sure, you can criticize Hillary Clinton. I do. She's too much of a war hawk and everything.
Sure.
Okay. But she's not an out-and-out Nazi. And this new channel might as well have a swastika as its emblem. It's almost certain it's going to be formed, continue on after the election date, and it's going to be ugly and dangerous, even more than it is now. And we don't know what powers are really behind Trump. You know, Hitler, to some extent, he wasn't just a figurehead or a patsy or a puppet, because he had his own brilliance as an orator and a propagandist.
Yeah.
And he really understood the public mind. That was probably his greatest gift. He was backed by the military, by the munitions makers, by corporate Germany. You know, people forget that. And of course, he launched World War II with a false flag operation.
Sure.
Claiming that the Poles had attacked a German radio station on the Polish-German border. It was complete fabrication, and that's how that...
So what's Trump going to do? Is he going to hire Alex Jones to be a 6 o'clock?
There's another angle to this. You know that there's been this meme, the conspiracist meme. Oh, you're just a conspiracy theorist. And that has been used to shut down as a thought stopper for practically anybody who wants to talk about evidence of state covert operations. It's been a real thought stopper, and the mainstream media have promoted that meme about conspiracy theorists. Now, Trump is one who has endorsed a certain amount of conspiracy theory. To some extent, he's become a banner waver for the idea that there are deep conspiracies. He talks
sure.
about global bankers and so on, and he's not off base on that. But yet he's the
worst. And that's the problem, right?
He's the worst possible advertiser for the truth.
Yeah.
Like, it's becoming very confused. And when there's chaos, then that's when demagogues prosper.
Novus Ordo Seclorum, order out of chaos.
See, authoritarians, the Hitlers of the world, when there's chaos, they say, I will be a strong man. People want a strong man then. They want a strong leader. They want a father figure, and they will gravitate toward that. In wars, like they gravitated to Churchill, of course.
Right.
And FDR in the States.
I'd love to be able to talk to you a couple of times a season with stuff like this, because you're always such a great, your reflections are so powerful.
Thank you. And so let's do it again after the election, let's say, because these things are so important that we really have to discuss them as freely as possible. Let 100 flowers bloom, take all the angles into account, and bring everybody to the table, because I fear it's a very darkening horizon. So on that happy note...
Oh, thanks a lot.
let me promote my November the 5th
Do that,
event at Bates Atoon on Markham Street in Toronto. Starts at 7 p.m., and I believe they're asking for a $5 donation or something.
And just a quick mini plug, too. Bates Atoon is a fantastic venue with a lot of great speakers on a bevy of important topics, and good to go to anytime, not just when Barry's there. You know, don't just be taken by his good boyish looks.
No. And also, it's ever more valuable. When things are coming to a conclusion, we seem to appreciate them more. And Bates Atoon has to close sometime in December for good.
Why?
Because the Mervish family have to tear it all down to make way for that new project. They're going to tear down Honest Ed's.
And it's Toronto. We have wonderful restaurants and attractions here, and then we tear them down and put up buildings you can live in where they used to be.
Not a knock on Mervish, really not. But anyway, for instance, he's such a good landlord. He gave the people 1 year of notice.
Yeah.
So that's pretty fair. So that as each event will get closer to the closing date and with a lump in our throat. And so we're going to look into the past, the 1600s, to see how people did it in those days. How did they start wars? How did they fool people? And it's good to learn that, because they're still doing it today.
Well, just have a cup of coffee and give your head a scratch, because Barry, you were there.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, thanks for coming on. You're such a wonderful guest and so full of information. I deeply respect your work. Barry, also, I should tell everybody before we hang up here, Barry, the reason I came across Barry in the first place is because, what was it, Barry, about 10 minutes after the second plane hit, you had a series of TV specials about 9/11 and the falsehood of it, and you were just asking logical, fair, reasonable, understandable questions. But you were doing it on the air in a media format on a television show on Vision TV back in the day. And I was blown away. And I'm sure there were a lot of other people going, listen to this guy. How's he saying all these things? Nobody else is asking these questions. And when did that come on? That was in January of 2002,
I think? It was early January. I had a 7-part series. It's a matter of historical fact, and I'm proud of it, that I was the first journalist to go on any national TV network in the world and seriously question the official story of 9/11. If there's room for that on my gravestone, I'll get it put there.
Well, hopefully we don't need to trot that gravestone out for any time soon. And looking at you, I doubt that's going to happen.
Well, the gravestone would have to be crowdsourced. I couldn't afford it.
Or maybe your gravestone would be so tall, we'd have to write all of your credits on it, and then a plane will fly into it, and it'll crumble to the ground, and everyone will believe it.
You know, the main thing is we're having fun here.
Oh, well, you ended on a dark note. Listen, I have to pull myself out of that stuff. There's no forgetting for me that this is dark, terrible, awful stuff, but you have to live, you got to be alive, and you got to have fun, and you have to make fun of it. And as soon as someone says, oh, this is a very serious topic, shouldn't make jokes,
yep.
Too bad. I am going to make jokes. I'm not going to be. That's part of the control system overall that we're railing against that says you can't make jokes about it when you're in the middle of talking about it. So get out of here.
That's right. And as has been accurately said about Donald Trump, the complete bully and narcissist, one thing that bullies and narcissists cannot stand is to be mocked, is to be laughed at. And he'll just rise to the bait if anybody criticizes him, especially laughs at him.
Yeah.
And that is why comedians are so important. And we all need to become comedians.
Yeah. Well, there are more of them out there than they know.
Yeah.
Anyway, listen, Barry, we'll ring off and we will catch
sure.
you again sometime. It's always wonderful speaking with you.
Yeah, I'll wait for your call. Bye for now, Alan.
Bye-bye,
thank
Barry.
You, thank you for the opportunity. Bye now.
Be sure to subscribe to Conspiracy Queries with Alan Parr on iTunes and to our YouTube channel. If you want to support the show and help create more episodes, you can become a patron at patreon.com/conspiracyqueries. We appreciate your feedback, so send us comments, complaints, or queries of your own to conspiracyqueries@gmail.com, or you can post them on our website at conspiracyqueries.com. Thanks for listening.